Fantastic. Borodar, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the next in the IWA series of Rethinking Wales conversations. My name's Auriel Miller. I'm the director of the IWA, and I'm really pleased to be with you this morning. For those of you who may not know who we are, we're Wales's leading independent think tank with a long track record of shaping debates, influencing change in Wales through policy research and advocacy. Our online and print publication, here's a copy of our latest magazine, The Welsh Agenda, which provide platforms for robust comment and debate, and our agenda are setting events. We're a membership organisation with members right across the country and far further afield too. We're funded by our members, the events we run ourselves, and independent trusts and foundations. This is our 11th Rethinking Wales panel conversation, and we'd really like to thank the Carnegie Trust for supporting us in this chunk of the series with their particular interest in wellbeing. So, many of us have done lots of Teams and lots of Zoom conversation so far already over the last 8 months. This is a Zoom webinar, so participants are muted by the host, and we're going to use the Q&A section for questions, please. If you'd like to direct your question to a particular panelist, please do state their name. We really encourage you to engage with each other in the chat too. We know it's not possible to meet up in person still, so that's really important. And please just remember that all chats and questions are recorded. I can see people starting to say hello in the chat, which is great. So nobody knows who else. The weird thing is nobody else knows who else is here unless you say hello in the chat. So do please say hello in the chat. That's part of the point of it. We're going to be keeping the event strictly to an hour to avoid Zoom overload, but we're going to keep the chat room open to 15 minutes after the end of the session in case you want to carry on the conversation. So that's the housekeeping bit welcome, and it goes without saying that cats, dogs, small children and so forth are all welcome interruptions we've all got used to. So huge welcome to everybody joining us today. We started this series of Rethinking Wales discussions way back in April, which feels like a lifetime ago, and the point of it was to shine a light on what matters to people now as our reality really continues to change and because we're still not able to meet up in person. So today we're the 26th of November, and we've got restrictions on meeting up continuing for the foreseeable future. Winter well and truly on its way, and the possibility of mass testing being rolled out across Wales after the trial currently taking place in Merthyr Tydfil at the moment. So today we really wanted to focus on the wellbeing of key workers and the ongoing impact that COVID-19 is having on those working on the front line, whether NHS staff, teachers, care workers or support workers. We're really interested in hearing about the immediate impact that the pandemic has had on key workers and what support mechanisms have been put in place to help them cope with the pressures that the COVID-19 response has put them under. Have we done enough, and are we doing enough to protect both these workers now and those roles for the future? Because we're going to need people in the future too. Can frontline sectors learn from other organisations' responses to COVID-19, and what lessons can policymakers learn from the experiences of frontline workers during the pandemic? We're going to hear from our panellists in a minute, but we also want to hear from you, both in the chat room and also on Twitter using the hashtag Rethinking Wales. I'm absolutely delighted to introduce today's panellists to you all today. We've got Katie Dalton, who's the director of Cymorth Cymru, the umbrella body for housing-related support and homelessness across Wales. Welcome, Katie. We've got Phil Busby, who's strategic programme lead from Health Edge. We've got Dylan Roberts-Young, who's the general secretary of ICAC, which represents teachers and people working in schools. I've just had a notification that my internet connection is unstable. So Andy, be at the ready in case I crash out, and I'll come back in a tick. And we've also got Oliver Townsend, who's head of partnerships and practice at Platform, the organisation that supports people with mental health issues. Katie, can I start with you, please, to talk a little bit more, please, about what sort of things have you been hearing from the members of Cymorth and the people that they're working with, and what sort of support structures have been in place for them over the last 8 months, and what are your main concerns?
Thank you very much, Oriel, and thanks for the invitation to come and speak today. As Oriel mentioned, we're the representative body for homelessness, housing and support providers in Wales, and our approximate 90 members cover people working in charitable support providers, housing associations and some local authority frontline services as well. And I think reflections on COVID are that this workforce has proved itself to be absolutely essential, but it's often hidden from view. We've seen a lot of recognition for health and social care workers, quite rightly, over the past 9 months. But I think most people are lucky enough not to ever need to come into contact with homelessness services, and therefore the awareness of them and what they've been doing is less well known. So I'll give you a kind of overview of what they've been doing and the challenges that they've experienced and some of the support that's been there for them. At the start of this pandemic, like many people, they faced huge uncertainty. They knew that they couldn't stop delivering services when the pandemic hit, that they would have to continue doing so every day of the week. Around 60,000 people are supported every year through homelessness and housing related support services in Wales, so quite large numbers. And many of those people are the most kind of vulnerable and marginalised in our society, with support needs from everything from youth homelessness and people who are care experienced, to people with mental health problems, substance misuse problems, older people and people with learning disabilities. I think at the start there was a sense that there wasn't enough guidance. I think that goes for all sectors, that we were dealing with something that was unprecedented. People didn't know how to deal with this sort of virus and weren't sure the impact of it. So there was lots of unknowns, but people still had to go out and deliver those support services. And I'm sure we'll hear from other colleagues on the panel about the challenges that that posed when people were unsure about what PPE was needed, what they should do with PPE if they even had it, where they could get it from. But we know that support workers continue to go out delivering face-to-face support, putting the health of themselves and their families at risk doing so, but they care hugely about the people that they support and wanted to make sure that they were there for them. I think they've had an extraordinary impact over the past 9 months. We know that over 3,000 people have been brought into emergency accommodation and given support, either from people who were sleeping on the streets, who were sleeping rough, or people who were insecure housing situations. Many people who were hidden homeless have come to services, people who might have been sofa surfing before, but that became untenable when the pandemic hit and people were asked to be very strict about households and isolation. So huge numbers have been presenting to homelessness services over the past 9 months, and the numbers speak for themselves, really. It's been an extraordinary effort. On top of those thousands of people who've presented to homelessness services, there's also been tens of thousands of people who were currently in homelessness and housing support services. So people in domestic abuse refuges, people in homeless hostels, people in supported accommodation, all who have support needs to help them to avoid homelessness and to keep safe. And that's been really challenging for lots of people. They've had significant trauma in their lives, lots of system failures from childhood through to adulthood. And, you know, lockdown's been very difficult for all of us. But for people who've had those significant traumas and the mental health and addiction issues that come with them, this has been even more challenging. And so making sure that those people are able to keep safe has been a real challenge for support workers. What we've seen is a real split in experiences. So at the start of the pandemic, many of our members had to think about prioritising services, who needed the face-to-face support and who could do with maybe digital support or telephone support. They were worried about staff capacity, so they had to do that risk assessment and prioritisation. So there's been some workers who've continued to go out there and deliver face-to-face, either in outreach on the streets, in supported accommodation settings, in emergency accommodation with 100 people being brought off the street. They've obviously had significant fears about infection, what that might mean for them, what they're taking home to their families. And, you know, as you can imagine, with people being locked down for several months on end, being told they can't leave the premises, there's been some challenging behaviour within some of those settings that have been quite difficult for staff to manage at times. So, you know, huge challenge, huge kind of trauma in those situations. And then on the other side, we've had staff who are delivering services digitally or by telephone. And their job continues to be challenging. They continue to have a day which might include several conversations with people about their experiences of childhood abuse, of suicide, of self-harm, of domestic abuse, of other traumas in their lives. But what they've been faced with is sitting in a room in front of a laptop on their own dealing with those conversations. Whereas in, you know, pre-COVID times, they'll have been able to go back to the office, have a cup of tea with a colleague, kind of reflect and talk about some of the conversations they've been having and kind of download and get that peer support. And actually being sat in your living room working at the moment is quite isolating if you're having some of those quite challenging, traumatic conversations every hour of your working day, even more so. And I think at the start, you know, we saw that people delivering face to face were feeling that they were in the most challenging circumstances. And I think as time has gone on, it's those who are sat in front of a laptop or a telephone who are increasingly finding the isolation and the buildup of those kind of challenges being felt more than those who actually are able to go out there, feel a bit more safe at the moment because they understand the PPE requirements, they understand the rules, and are getting some sense of normality and structure from being able to go out and be around other people. So that's a really interesting kind of split across the workforce. In terms of support that they've been able to access, I think that's varied on the capacity of the organisation to deliver that. So yeah. We've got large members, small members, and I think that, you know, where people have had resource, they've been able to provide that support, sometimes clinical support, but for others, it hasn't been there. And what we'd certainly like in the future is a levelling of that playing field where services are commissioned in a way that that support is available to every support worker regardless of organisation.
Thank you, Katie. That's a really, really helpful and clear exposition of what the key concerns are and that change over time. Phil, I'm going to come to you next from the point of view of the healthcare workers in Wales. I just need to change my screen so that I can see you better. There we go. Phil, over to you.
Excellent. Well, thank you for the invitation, Auriel. And I think some of the things that I would share will be very similar to the pressures and the types of issues that Katie was talking about. Because although clearly health and care workers were right at the front of this, the pressures, whether that's on the telephone, face-to-face with patients, or that sense of isolation if you're working from home, then those type of pressures are very similar, I think, irrespective of which sector people work in. I'll explain some of the work that I've been involved in over the months, and that might help highlight perhaps some of the issues that health and care workers have been involved in. But I think there's going to be a lot of common ground to some of the things that Katie. Mm-hmm. At the start of the pandemic, I was working in Public Health Wales, and I'll always remember the end of February, that February half term, when Italy got added to the list of countries that we were concerned about in terms of COVID, and the sudden influx of telephone calls that came into Public Health Wales at that point, and seeing that initial pressure, the responsiveness of the organisation to cope with that increase in telephone calls, to deal with concerned members of the public, to deal with medical professionals that were looking for advice from Public Health Wales, was an incredible response. And I think in those initial days, whether it was in public health or from the health boards within Wales, we saw fantastic response from a whole range of teams, whether it was people on the front line or people providing support to those people on the front line. And I think a lot of that was, you know, adrenaline carried people through as we responded to that initial wave. I think some of the concerns that we have got in terms of managing that health and care of staff have been longer term. And one of the things that I got involved with during March and April was leading a group in conjunction with Welsh Government, trade union officials, a range of other employers, including Social Care Wales, and local governments and universities, just thinking about what is the immediate impact, what can we do to support staff in the short term, but also what can we do in the longer term. And I think it's that longer term support that we are increasingly interested in, because it is going to be those impacts for staff over a period of time, perhaps not just this year, next year, perhaps future years, where people are going to feel the impact in terms of their mental health, in terms of what they've had to deal with during the course of this year. A bit like when I've stopped talking, I'll perhaps put a link into the chat bar of a very short piece that was on Channel 4, which I think is only about 7 or 8 minutes, that highlighted some of the issues that staff at our Naira and Bevan Health Board were facing during the early years, and talking about some of those things that I've expressed. And so I think it is going to be the longer term support that we can give. And the advantage of some of the work that we did in March and April was that we weren't just thinking about healthcare workers, we were thinking as well about members of staff across the social care sector as well, and trying to put things in place for both sectors. There are 11 different employers within the NHS in Wales, and obviously a myriad of employers within the social care environment, and just trying to think about what's happening in those employers. There's lots of good things happening to support staff, and how can we collate those and bring those together? And a colleague of mine within Health Education Improvement Wales, HEIW, has collated all of that information together and put that and made that available on the HEIW website. So anybody looking at on the call today can go onto that website and have a look at the resources that we pulled together there that people can access in terms of the support. But what we also considered is could we do more for staff over the longer term, and can we invest in services once for Wales rather than, you know, lots of separate and different employees? And that was really useful, putting in some dedicated support with the Samaritans, expanding a service called Health for Health Professionals, so that our members of staff could access very easily some support if they weren't able to get that from elsewhere as well. So I think I'll conclude by just reflecting a little bit on the longer term. And although COVID clearly has had an impact on all of our lives and all of our objectives during the year, I don't think we've lost sight of the longer term impacts, and the fact that the importance of health and well-being of our people isn't just as a result of COVID. We were thinking about this anyway. It's in a lot of the strategies and the strategic documents. The Future Generations Act, Healthier Wales, spoke about the importance of the health and well-being of our staff. And I think that will continue to be a very, very important theme. I know, for example, today a lot of the health boards and trusts, their boards are meeting, and I know several of them are talking about the importance of staff health and well-being. If you haven't had enough of my voice, you're very welcome to join the HEIW board in about an hour and a half, where we'll be talking again about the importance of staff health and well-being at a public showcase event. So a bit of a plug.
Great, thanks.
I'll stop there, Aurel, and
thanks very much indeed for that. That's super, super helpful. Dylan, can we come to you in terms of teachers and people working in schools, and talk us through what you've been hearing? Because one thing you shared just before the call was there are 10 different trade unions working in schools, you know, in representing people who are working in schools. And I didn't know that there were 10. That's a lot of coordination to go on.
Yes, I'm Dylan Roberts-Young. I'm General Secretary of ICAC, and we represent teachers, leaders, and lecturers in further and higher education as well. We have been working together as trade unions with Welsh Government and the WLGA, the Welsh Local Government Association, and I'll come back to that relationship a little later on. In terms of what our members have been experiencing, you know, the initial need to take care of themselves and the pupils. And we're talking here of well-being, but also ensuring that the education is still an important element. It seems a bit strange to say that education has to be an important element, but you know, you've got to think about that life balance of providing that education, but also care for pupils and also for their own families. We've had a lot of professional development in terms of moving to a more blended learning approach, and the challenges involved with blended learning in terms of engagements with pupils, engagements with colleagues, and also when working from home, the need to care for their own well-being and the well-being of their families. So there's been a real professional development over a very short period of time. And there have been challenges. For example, if you look at broadband inequity throughout Wales, whereas we've discussed already in this meeting that we've got contingency plans for this meeting in terms of broadband. But if you think about rural communities, or we look at poverty in terms of technology in the household, but there are positive elements as well in terms of that professional development. I was for over 10 years working in initial teacher training, and suddenly we see connection in terms of professional development where there had been a disconnect, in that initial teacher training is working closely with consortia and local authorities in terms of identifying areas that needs to develop, or gaps that have occurred in initial teacher training due to the last 9 months. The concerns in terms of safety is consistency and clarity in terms of the consistency. Before this meeting, I was sending emails discussing face coverings with Welsh Government in terms of the expectations on school and what is deemed to be a public space, because there are so many challenges in terms of working within a classroom and ensuring the social distance in a classroom, and also the challenges in terms of pupils outside the school gates and parents outside the school gates. We've seen a number of worrying developments recently where schools are being closed because of instances of COVID. And, early on, we did feel in education that there was this idea that it wasn't going to impact schools, it doesn't impact pupils. But of course, a school is a whole community. So there are so many adults within the schools, and also the broader society impacts what's happening in school. In terms of support, Welsh Government have had a number of initiatives which are welcomed. I'll just outline some of them. But we are worried about consistency from local authority, from one local authority to another. We've seen extremely good practice in some authorities and lack of capacity to support within other authorities. In terms of Welsh Government's involvement in various initiatives, I think it's been interesting in terms of the way there has been dialogue between people who are doing work. There is a tendency to think that there was isolated work happening, or there was no connection between good work that was happening. For example, I'm involved on the advisory board of the Education Supports, which is a charity for all those involved in education. And they've held, and I'll also link into the chat, a conference that was held in terms of well-being of school-based staff, which was very well received, and also various projects to support head teachers, and also incorporating work that's being done by the Mindfulness in Education Network. So I think it's positive in terms of the connect between various groups, but also we need to be looking in terms of funding this kind of connection long term, and reflecting on what is being achieved at the moment, so that we can build on it for the long term.
That's really interesting. I'm going to move on to Oliver, if I may, please, Dylan. I think one of the things here that I'm hearing coming through is that connectivity within the sector being strengthened. And let's hear, Oliver, in terms of your organisation platform and what you've experienced. I know you're a recent addition to the platform team, but thinking about where you want to take things in the future and the other work that you're involved with across the UK, could you set out some of that systems thinking that we've been talking about?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, first of all, for inviting me to speak. It's a bit intimidating because I'm here with two of my former line managers. Absolutely no pressure for me not to say anything wrong. But yeah, no, it's an absolute pleasure to talk today. And I would just agree and echo what everyone else has already said. I think, first of all, the pressures on frontline workers in particular is massive. And I just wanted to start before I say anything else by just saying a massive thank you to those people, you know, because it's all very well me sitting here in a nice, comfortable, heated room and I'm having these lovely panel discussions. But actually, as we're having this quite pleasant intellectual conversation, there are people who are living and breathing other people's pain. And I think that's got to be the context that we really hear this conversation in. And I think we've got to really challenge ourselves to remember the real story that's happening around us. So for us at Platform, we've been part of, it's due to be launched next week, so I'll share the link to the events to book on once I've finished. We're launching something called the New System Alliance, which is set up as a joint endeavour between ourselves, Mayday Trust in England, Changing Lives in Northern England, and Homeless Network Scotland in Scotland. The clue's in the name. And that is a way, really, for organisations to come together. And rather than tweaking or kind of wondering about how to do things a little bit better, to really challenge ourselves as people delivering services, what is it that we're getting wrong and how can we actually make things better? And for us, that's a big... I hate this phrase because it sounds really kind of intellectual, but bear with me as I say it, but a big paradigm shift. But what we mean by that is, you know, and I'm not going to get into the intellectual details of it. What we mean by that is looking at a system that is failing in a lot of places. And that's not a judgment on the way people deliver services, because people deliver services amazingly well in all parts of Wales, but they deliver it in a context where maybe the measurement of what they're doing is wrong, or the commissioning is made difficult by kind of outdated rules or procurement exercises. So one of the things I'd really like to say, first of all, is when kind of you see Platform talking about systems change and paradigm shifts, it's definitely meant from a positive perspective of everyone getting involved to look at what we can do differently. The reason why I'm really keen to talk about it today, I think, is because what often gets neglected is the impact of working in a failing system on the front line. We talk a lot about the people that they support, and they are always the most important. But today's conversation is a chance to talk about the trauma that you might end up holding if you are trying to work with someone. For example, someone presents as homeless to a local authority, and the frontline housing officer is confronted with a human being in very real pain and distress. And they, as a human being, want to reach out, console them, give them a solution, or help them find accommodation at its most simple. But the rules and processes, either of rationing, of lack of funding, lack of housing to go into, lack of services, forces that housing officer to make a decision that is not human. They make a decision that that person doesn't deserve housing or can't get housing yet, for example. And I think that is something that gets overlooked a lot, is what trauma does that do? What trauma does that give, I suppose, to that frontline worker? So that's kind of where we're coming at it, I think, in terms of systems change, is making it easier for people on the front line to make decisions that are human rather than systems led. And there's a lot more to it. There's a lot more intellectual kind of grounding to it. But one of the things that I've promised myself that I will not do is over intellectualizing conversations. I want to talk about people's real experiences. And on that, you know, in terms of sort of what Platform are trying to do outside of that systems change work, but just making the current situation just a bit more bearable for people who are struggling, is we've recently set up Breathe, which is a counselling arm for Platform, where any profits from that private counselling go into the not-for-profit work of the charity. But what's really exciting about that is, for example, the BMA, the British Medical Association, have recently commissioned Breathe to offer some support to frontline GPs. You know, again, we sort of see frontline workers as maybe people who are support workers, but we also often forget that GPs, psychologists are also on the frontline as well. You know, everyone who is engaging with people with pain will be carrying some form of trauma. And what we've tried to do with Breathe is make available a whole range of psychological interventions. So not just traditional counselling, but also other types as well. So that becomes a very person-focused response to people's trauma. And I think that links as well to the fact that we want to change the system so that not just people reading off a list of rules or processes, but we're actually starting to ask ourselves, what is the human response to people's pain, to people's experience, to people's trauma, and how do we change services and systems around people so that that becomes the default response rather than following a list or process? So that's it in a nutshell, hopefully a bit shorter than 5 minutes.
In a nutshell, but a huge challenge ahead. So there are lots of common themes coming through this conversation. Katie, I'm going to come back to you next and sort of draw a parallel between some of my own experiences working in international humanitarian crisis, where you would be cycled out of the situation every 3 months by your employer to decompress and get away from the conflict and have a chance to be yourself without any of the responsibilities in any of the situation that you were living in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, ad infinitum. This situation, this experience, this collective experience for all of us doesn't have those boundaries. It's not possible to do that. It's not possible to say, stop, I've had enough. I just need to breathe away from, and it's interesting, it's a very well chosen term for the support service in terms of breathe, but it's not possible to do that. It's not possible to abstract yourself from real life because this is everybody's real life for the time being. So what sort of things are you seeing? Because there's clearly burnout, there's clearly exhaustion, there's physical, mental exhaustion, and the triple loads that people are experiencing as parents, as partners, looking after elderly relatives, as well as doing the day job. I mean, that's a huge bundle of stuff to deal with. What sort of things are organisations doing to start thinking about, you can't take a holiday in this. How are people managing?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's been absolutely relentless. And I think to put it into context, a year ago, we were saying to the Welsh Government, the housing support grant, which funds homelessness and housing support services in Wales, has faced real term cuts of £37 million over the last decade, and services are at a tipping point. And then COVID came along, yeah. And organisations are continuing to support those 60,000 people already in services and are now on top of that supporting, you know, more than 3,000 additional people who've come into the system. So that is the context. And you're right, people haven't been able to take breaks. And it's really interesting because, you know, there's one thing that I'll probably reflect on later about how the homelessness sector with Welsh Government has tried to look to the longer term. But what that meant is that services were doing the kind of crisis response for the first few months. And then there was a challenge to think about the long term and come up with plans and proposals to spend a bunch of capital and revenue money to do some kind of longer term thinking. But that came at a point where people were thinking about taking a week off. So they then had to cancel all of their leave, spend 3 weeks trying to put together these vast proposals for longer term systems change. And then infection started increasing again. So it has just been relentless. And, you know, whether that's people on the very front line or whether that's managers carrying this huge load of decision making, it's been really hard. Some of the things that services have done is some where they've had the resource have transferred, basically expanded some of the psychological support services that they have for people using services and expanded those to staff so that staff have been able to get access to maybe telephone counselling. Some have used, you know, informal things like really regular, short, informal team meetings to catch up. Some people have put kind of, you know, communal lunch breaks in a Zoom meeting and people can pop in and touch base. Some people have provided mindfulness sessions for staff. Others have rewarded with maybe extra leave during this year. But I think, as I've said before, that's really piecemeal and it's not systemic. That depends on the resources of that organisation. Much reserves do they have? How good are they at fundraising? And it means that there's very different experiences happening across the sector.
Very catchy, isn't it? Yeah.
And one of the things we would like to see is for commissioning to be much more psychologically informed. So we talk about the importance of the relationship with the person using the service, but as all reflected, the support for the person delivering the service is critical. And at the moment, we don't have, you know, enough services where people have time for reflective practice, where people have time for the clinical supervision. provision that's absolutely needed for some of those kind of really traumatic situations. So, and that's as a result of austerity, you know, and what we need is more funding in the system so that services can be commissioned with time and space and resource to look after those staff who are our most valuable asset. So at the moment, the system doesn't enable that. So it relies on the resources of each individual organisation and their fundraising capacity, which means we've got such an uneven playing field.
And so that's even within one sector. Phil, I'm going to come to you and then Derwin afterwards. So you talked a little bit, Phil, about, and thanks, Katie, that's helpful, in terms of, you know, wanting to make sure that what's being offered for healthcare workers is also involved for, is also offered for social care workers, but because we know that they're not perceived in the same, we weren't clapping for social care workers at the beginning, were we? We were clapping for healthcare workers predominantly. And it was a very different, as a, you know, we know that there's a very different public understanding now of the roles that social care workers provide and the support they provide. How is that working in terms of joining up and making sure that everybody is included? Because a person is a person, no matter who they work for or what kind of support their organisation can afford to offer them, they're going to experience the same types of feelings and the same kinds of pressures as anybody else. That shouldn't, the support they get shouldn't be predicated by who they work for, should it?
No, and you know, completely understand that. I mean, the sectors are obviously different and have had different pressures, but lots of similarities as well. And some work that was going on before COVID was a joint piece of work between the NHS in Wales and social care in Wales in terms of developing a strategy looking ahead to bring those two sectors far closer together. That strategy was written prior to the pandemic, but has been published during the pandemic. So that there is clear intention there to work far more closely together as the two sectors. And as I said earlier, some of the work that we did during March, April, May was working between the NHS and Social Care Wales far closer together to think about how can we get some investment that will be appropriate for groups of staff, both within the NHS and within the social care sector. So it's something that we have looked at and developed things closely together, NHS, Social Care Wales working far more closely together, perhaps than has ever been done before, both from a strategic point of view and also because of the pandemic has enabled that to happen. So, you know, we're seeing some things practically happen there, but, you know, I can't pretend that the social care and the health sectors are completely the same. They are different, and there are different pressures and different priorities for the two sectors. And I think priorities is one of the key things, just picking up on some of the things that Katie was saying in her answer and some things, Auriel, you were saying in your introduction to this section. I think, you know, you're right. We can't rota people out for 3 months and you know, allow that sense to recharge. So we've got to think about ways that we can do it within the working space, because the people that we have got are the people that we will need through this winter peak now and into next year. And you know, burnout is a risk, and we need to look after people as well as possible. And that will be different things for different people. So some of those things that Katie has talked about, some of those informal things, some things that we can do as a team that local employers can do, are going to be vital for other people. There's going to be a whole range of different things where people can recharge and get their energies from. I saw one of the things popping up on the chat bar about alternative therapies and all those type of things. And we've explored a whole range of different things, whether they're traditional or, you know, working closely with the arts sector, for example, to think about the role that arts could play. Perhaps social prescribing can play in terms of people being able to have downtime and to recharge and to allow them to continue to work and support us all through the next few months, which I think is going to be absolutely vital. As a closing point from me on this section is that the role the public can play. You know, we've talked about prioritisation through the early months of the pandemic response. The NHS chose very clearly to prioritise COVID over some other things. We know that. And that prioritisation will continue to a greater or lesser extent. And the public can play a role in that. As I was talking to some of my colleagues from the Welsh Ambulance Service and grateful for the support from members of the public, and also choosing well in terms of how they engage with the ambulance service and the things that they ask them to do as well. And that And that helps as well in terms of the pressure coming through to the system.
A different kind of public information campaign, isn't there, I think? And I'm sure, like many people, I've had a note through my door today from Welsh Government saying these are the things you need to keep remembering to do over the next period of time. Dylwyn, you know, one of the issues, obviously, for Wales, bearing in mind where we are, we're conscious of the situation we have at the moment and also situations that we want to shift, particularly in terms of, for instance, poverty and deprivation. Intergenerational change happens through education. So you've got a double whammy there, haven't you, of delivering for the people now and delivering for the adults that they will become and the children that will come after them. You talked a little bit before about how that that innovation is being captured. Can you explain that you're noticing it, but can you explain how that's being captured and shared, please, across the education system? Because, you know, you pointed out before, schools and further education, higher education institutions are communities in themselves, aren't they, with anchor institutions in a place. And that's something that we've seen come through loud and clear over the last 8 months now. It's not a few, it's a lot of months. So there's that in terms of the place-based thing, but you've also got the system as a whole and the uncertainty, and you know, some of that uncertainty being leavened by the decision about exams for next year, but that loads another layer of uncertainty in terms of what happens after that, doesn't it? So you've got, it's huge.
Yeah, and I remember receiving an email very early on, I think in the first week of the pandemic, saying that we've got to drop all kinds of concerns for terms and conditions, trade union or not. We've got to go the extra mile. We've got to add to our responsibilities. But of course, that was without understanding that this was going to be something very long term. Yeah. And teachers, leaders, lecturers are extremely tired. That our role continues to be in terms of ensuring that terms and conditions are respected within the challenges of the work. There, when we look at the Fair Wales vision that we have, we are looking at important principles in terms of creating a real partnership between employers, government, and trade unions. And I think this period has allowed this to happen. I think it was a difficult challenge in terms of understanding the roles, but also trusting each other. But we've been sort of thrown in together. And this has allowed us to look at important elements. Earlier this morning, I had a meeting on managing workload and bureaucracy, which had all agencies involved. And of course, that is a long-term aspiration, as well as looking at what's happening at the moment. Supply teachers, you know, there are supply teachers at the moment who are in a very vulnerable position of not having any employment or having employment which is as little as £59 a day. And if you think about the travelling that they do, you know, it is, you know, putting them in a really vulnerable position. Exams, assessment. You know, we are being thrown into a very important discussions which might have long-term implications. Mm. Not only does that have implications in terms of the pupils and the teachers, but also the broader society of looking at the expectations of parents, expectations of employers, and understanding of what it means in terms of examinations, in terms of assessments. So I think with the Social Partnership Act, it can create a real sense of partnership, and what that, you know, what that has to encapsulate is the trust that we have for each other, that we're working together for a better education system, but really for a better, fairer Wales, which will allow us to look at all issues of equality, of health, looking at flexible work policies, job security. And a workplace which is, as the title tells us, a fairer workplace for all involved in terms of my concern, education system, but in the broader sense of employment as well.
So a lot of these concerns are concerns that will be shared by other sectors too. Ol, yeah. I know you wanted to come in next.
Yeah, just really quickly, because it would be good to answer some of the questions as well. But just to say that platform during the kind of period of lockdown and a bit before and a bit beyond, we engaged in an exercise where we heard from people working in all across Wales, but particularly around the third sector. And we heard from over 250 people who are either working or volunteering in public life in some way around particularly mental health, but other areas as well. And we're going to be publishing kind of that at some point soon. But the three key points for me that came out of there, which I think speak to some of the stuff Katie was talking about, trauma-informed commissioning, you know, person-centered education, and some of the stuff Phil was talking about, supporting the social care and health workforce. And this is really part of the systems change stuff that I think, again, we need to just keep at the front of our mind when we're talking about things, that we don't processize, that's not a word, but you know what I mean, turn everything into a process, a quick fix, a sticking plaster. Three things that people have really found as enablers to work differently and to address some of their well-being concerns. Leadership that should be open to vulnerability, kindness, kind leadership, building responses and solutions together, and that needs a whole change in the way that we see leadership, particularly during and post-COVID. And at the moment, too much of the system that we all operate in is based on kind of saviour leadership or competition between organisations. And actually, if we're really going to make big changes, that's some of the things we need to address. The other one is, and this is a subject really close to my heart, but also is really important in terms of systems change, is moving away from the individualization of problems, so that yes, organizations should be aware of people's trauma, and that's an amazing journey that Wales has gone on. Part of the next step of that, which I know Katie and Cymorth are working on, is what are the impacts of society on that trauma? And actually, for people, you know, we've all heard the old myth, and if anyone still uses it, please stop using it, about we're all two or three paychecks away from homelessness. You know, we're not. I'm not, because if I lose my job tomorrow because I do a really bad presentation at an IWA event, then I will be able to go and live with my mum or find a friend, you know, or get a new job. If I'm living in abject poverty and I've had childhood trauma, I don't have that capital and those resources to draw on. So our system has to be flexible enough to consider that. And then finally, creativity. You know, that is something that, you know, Katie's again talked about. Sorry, it sounds like I'm just picking up on Katie's points. It's not just because I used to work there, Katie, but all of those options about making space, making you know, time available at lunch. We need to have leadership that when it's open and vulnerable, when it listens to the individualization of problems, it then seeks to make a space to be creative, to find different responses. So I just wanted to say that that's all part and parcel of what we need to do to make changes to the system.
Thank you. I think that's really helpful. And we've seen how the kinds of social capital that you were talking about there, both individual and collectively, community, has operated in a totally different way. I'm going to pick up on some of the questions from the chat and the Q&A thing that have come through. So there's one from John Galandis about there's a need to recognise that informal unpaid carers are a huge part of society response to care, and they should get equitable recognition. If they didn't exist, council and health systems couldn't cope. So how do we move to a space that gives that recognition? Phil, can I come to you, please, and also then to you, Katie, after that?
Yeah, I think it's vital. And just listening to the question then, I was thinking about, you know, me as a person rather than me as an employee of the NHS, because I think we all recognise the importance of caring. You know, probably everybody on the call, whether they're a panelist or just joining us for the hour, can relate to stories where we have to care for children or elderly relatives. And you know, that's an important part of all of our roles and all of our lives. I think there is recognition of the importance of that, and undoubtedly, you know, without the care that you know we provide to certain members of our family, then there would be a greater burden on the NHS. So I'm not sure that people aren't recognised. I think we do recognise those, and I think there is an importance placed on the roles that each of us play in that. So, you know, whether we will ever get that quite in the same way that we are showing the appreciation for those that are employed in the sectors that are represented on this call, I don't know. But I think there is a tremendous value in the work that, that everybody does in terms of looking after each other and for the care that is provided.
So thank you. Thank you, Phil. I think, Katie, I was in a call last week with an organisation called New Local, which is the new name for the New Local Government Network, and very clearly hearing about how local authorities are going to need to work very differently with local and community organisations, and I would say including people who are unpaid carers in that mix as well, but not only. You talked a little bit about some of the rules and regulations going, if not out the window, definitely being relaxed in the early days. And obviously there's issues around public spend and the accountability of that spend and decision making and so forth. What sort of recommendations would you have for the kinds of things that you would want to see continuing into whatever the next stage of our future is on this around? I mean, I know you talked a little bit about commissioning needing to shift, but it's a different way of working entirely, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think on the unpaid carers thing, I think the where appropriate financial support through the welfare system needs to be appropriate, where those people are doing so and losing resources. I think flexibility from employers is a way that we as a whole population can support people in caring responsibilities. And thirdly, listening to people's voices in those situations and co-producing guidance, policy, etc., with those people in those experiences of unpaid caring. And that links nicely to, I think, some of the things that we want to take forward from this. So, Aurel, you talked about losing the bureaucracy, focusing on what needed to be done, and that really helped in the first few months of the crisis. So, you know, the minister said, here's £10 million to get people off the streets and into accommodation and provide support. You know, if it achieves that, then pay for it. You know, we're not going to put loads of red tape and bureaucracy around it, because that will just stop getting people inside. And we know that people on the streets are at huge risk. And you're right, there has to be a level of accountability for public money. But I think it's getting that balance right. And are there things that we can take from this experience, which reduces some of that kind of bureaucracy and reporting, that enables people to focus on the person and what is necessary for them, but also gives that accountability. And I think linked to my previous point, it's that co-production and cooperation. And actually, from a homelessness perspective, we've really experienced that from Welsh Government. Late February, I said, I'm really worried. This population is at huge risk of dying from COVID if it starts spreading. And they said, OK, send us some scenarios and we'll start to work that up. And from that moment onwards, we were around the table helping to draft the guidance that governed the response to COVID in the homelessness sector. And that has been invaluable. We've been getting key issues off members every single week. Government have been responding to those, using those to prioritise what needed to happen in terms of policy and guidance. Our kind of co-drafting of the guidance enabled us to alert government to possible and intended consequences before they happened. And so I think that has been a really fantastic element going forward. We want to see more of that continue, because it means we get it right first time, rather than seeing various iterations of plans and policies moving forward. And that really close link between frontline, representative bodies, government decision making is really critical.
I think that's you've illustrated certainly my own experience as well very neatly there about how you shorten that distance travel between what people are experiencing and who are the people who are setting out not only the decisions but setting what that means for the future. So that's a good example of that. But I know from our conversations early on, Katie, that you know that was round the clock working for you and the team, as well as people actually doing the doing of it too. So when I'm going to come to you next, because there are two questions I think which are helpful. One is, are you noticing in the education sector issues with the recruitment and retention of staff because of these constant waves of changes coming through? And I know that's Karen Delamy is saying that, you know, that's becoming a bit of an issue. What are you doing about that? And then another question, which comes from Andy, saying he's a primary school governor. One thing he's tried to make sure fellow parents understand is that as well as being a school, they're also now a public health body. Do you think schools and staff are getting enough support with a sudden extra responsibility that goes beyond what the delivery, you know, what the service is, isn't it? What else do they need? You're just on mute, I'm afraid. We're going to need to, yeah.
I'll come to the first one sure. In terms of recruitment. You will see from the Education Workforce Council's data that there isn't a problem with recruitment. And there are people who are seeing that there's a lack of job security in other sectors, feeling that education does provide some form of security. However, I've written a recent article for the IWA in terms of recruitment, in that there is a concern. There is a concern in terms of how people are feeling threatened and vulnerable in the present situation, and that hasn't really registered yet. One of the early registrants is that people are moving to working part-time to try and get some kind of a balance, a balance of life and work. And the article I wrote was on Welsh medium recruitment, in that it's a growing sector. We're working towards 1 million Welsh speakers, and that has to be planned. The broader discussion there is the lack of support in terms of well-being, the Welsh language well-being and counselling support, okay. And training. With the other matter, it's so good to hear somebody who is in the education community who's acknowledging the additional challenges, and it's something that really needs to be worked upon. And one concern we had was that Welsh Government actually had said that governance meetings didn't have to be held, whereas we felt that it really had to be held in terms of really getting to grips with well-being.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I've been a governor as well for 5.5 years, and I can, that's a whole heap of stuff that needs to be worked through, needs to be talked through. We're running out of time. I'm just wondering, I mean, a couple of things. There's a couple of questions that I'd like to, and maybe we'll follow up with a couple of panellists separately. So there's a question here from Mark Temple about how will HEIW work to encourage time out to reflect in future and encourage ideas from the coalface and remove the top-down approach to development. So perhaps we can pick up on that separately. But I'm wondering whether it'd be worth repeating this conversation in about 6 months' time to see where we are. Maybe 6 months is too short. I don't know, because I think some of the things that we've been coming through are going to take years to sort of filter through the system in terms of that systemic change. But there's obviously an issue here in terms of keeping a finger on the pulse of where people are at and what are those innovations. I mean, for instance, the kinds of things you're talking about, Katie, around getting people to share and be able to offload in those lunchtime Zoom calls, for instance, how is that happening for people working in healthcare or people who are out and about providing support who may not be seeing people on a day-to-day basis because they're doing all that travel separately and independently. And I think what's interesting as well is how that shift from people being dealing with patients and dealing with supporting people and not knowing about PPE and the infection from the virus at the beginning of all of this. So that shift at so many people working digitally or remotely and feeling increasingly isolated and increasingly unsure. And I retweeted, I think yesterday, a really interesting, I thought, table of, how do you know where you are on that spectrum of okay? I'm surviving at this end. I'm thriving at this end. I'm surviving, I'm struggling, and I'm really in crisis. Do we all have the language? Are we used to talking about it in those sorts of ways? Do we have those conversations enough with the people around us that we see all the time? I've got a very quick, a final request from Ol. So I'm going to come to you first, and then I'm going to wrap up.
Yeah, it was just to say, I think one of the things that I'd meant to say and hadn't is, in order to respond to any of these crises, we need to have our services be human. And I know I said that at the beginning, but also what I mean by that in practical terms is, if someone comes to a service or a person, let's humanize it. If someone comes to a person with an issue or a challenge or a problem, we should stop trying to say, oh, that's not our job, that's not our service. You know, things like primary schools being the public health body, you know, that's because that's what people need at that stage. You know, and I'm just really struck and probably want to just pay tribute really to Sophie Howe with the Domestic Abuse Fund, because that's a classic example, is that as an employer, she doesn't have a legal duty to provide financial support for her employees if they find themselves in a position of domestic abuse, but she's done it because she's recognised that that's a moral duty and a moral responsibility. And I think that's just a point that I'd really like to finish on, is that one of the problems with the system is we always sort of seem to pass the buck onto the next person or the next service. And I think we need to really think as a human being, let's respond first and then ask whose job it is later.
So thank you. That's a really helpful addition, because the Children's Commissioner has a similar set of priorities, which is called No Wrong Door. Doesn't matter which door you're coming in through, we will get you to the right, we will get the right support to you rather than get you to the right service, depending on where that's funded from and who that's accountable. We're accountable to you as the child, and we will wrap the support around you. Thank you very much indeed, everybody, for joining the conversation today. I know there's been some good chat in the side panel. I'd really like to thank our panelists for giving us their time: Katie Dalton, Phil Busby, Dilwyn Roberts-Young, and Oliver Townsend. Like I said at the start, this is the 11th in our series of Rethinking Wales sessions. Our next one is going to be in a couple of weeks' time, on the 10th of December. If you want to receive early notifications of future IWA events and recordings of all of our Rethinking Wales sessions in your inbox, please do join us as a member at iwa.wales about us and support us. It's a way that you can play your part in supporting an openly politically independent organisation at a critical juncture for Wales. And if I can just add, you know, it's been really interesting running an organisation that doesn't represent a particular sector, trade or interest over the last 8 months, because it has meant that we've been able to take a step back and bring people together who have been formerly really focused on the delivery to try and learn some of these lessons and extract some of these issues for policymakers. We're going to leave the chat room open for another 15 minutes or so, so do carry on there if you'd like to. And we've also got a Dupol, which we'll share in the chat room now for you to share any reflections on COVID-19's impact on Wales more broadly. Just a trailer for a piece of work that we're launching on the 8th of December, and that Ol was involved in with me, and Katie still is as Camorth. Looking at people's stories from the pandemics and how do we capture these sorts of innovations right across every single sector. It's sort of a mirror of what Audit Wales are doing with public sector bodies on different ways of working and how to capture the innovations. So do come along to that. It's advertised on the IWA Wales website. So thank you very much indeed again for taking part, everybody. And I hope you get to enjoy some of the sunshine that there is at the moment outside. Cheerio.